same goes for if I want to buy a car and I have to talk to my wife. You know, I made the decision, but now she has to make the decision. So she has to read the brochure, she has to do the calculations on the funds and the finances. And then finally, there's the confirmation stage. At the confirmation stage, you say, oh, I implemented this, and this actually brought what I wanted to do. And that really helps, because then you spread the word, so to speak. So individuals make the decisions. What are those decisions based upon? And this is, again, generic. It's a number of things. Compatibility, relative advantages, complexity, simplicity, triability, and observability. Complexity and simplicity. Is this easy? Does this fit into my relative simple way of doing things? Or does it bring a lot of complexity? If it does bring a lot of complexity, people tend to decide against an innovation. Relative advantage. Does the innovation bring a relative improvement to what I do today? Compatibility. Is this compatible with what I did yesterday? Or do I have to change my life in order to work with this new innovation or do something? Triability. Can I try the innovation just easily and see if it has effect? And observability. Does the innovation bring me some cool? Can I talk about it in the bar? Yeah? Or if it is about detergents, are my clothes actually cleaner or do they smell better? Now, if you look at DNSSEC, IPv6, routing security, and all the other innovations at the waist of the hourglass, the answers to all these decisions things are very weak. Relative advantage, complexity, simplicity, compatibility, triability, all those things are very hard to establish. If you turn on DNSSEC yourself as the first person in the world, you cannot try if it works. So, what to do? What can you do if you build technology and you're innovating? What can we do generally if we want to innovate at the waist of the hourglass? Well, there's this thing, there's this other component to the story. If you make the decision specifically on that waist of the hourglass to implement something, then the relative advantage has a value component. And one of the things you shouldn't distract is distract value from the people who want to try. And then you're fighting Metcalfe's law. The value of a network is proportional to the number of users times the log of the number of users. And that means that if you bring technology into the network and it breaks the value for all the other ones in the network, they're not going to like you. If you decrease the value of the network for your users because you put an innovation in that makes them harder to communicate with 6 billion other people, they're not going to like it. So it is upon you as the implementer to make sure that you're compatible with the rest of the world. And that makes for a very hard proposition. You have early deployer's disadvantage. Normally, innovations bring early deployer advantages. If I modify seeds and I have a much higher productivity with my seeds than my competitors, then the bulk price of the seed is the same, while my gain is higher, so I have more profit. And the late people who deploy will have seen that the price of the bulk is going down because everybody is using those seeds except for they, and they have a low gain on those seeds. So with normal innovations that cut down the price for producing something, the story is easy to tell, but not for IPv6 and DNSSEC and all these other innovations. So what can we do? What can we do in order to make that story a little bit easier? Observability is one of the things that you can do. In IPv6, we had IPv6 World Day and IPv6, the 2 days. Those were events that had two purposes. Make observable for the people who wanted to try, but also say, this is our common vision. This is what we want to establish. If you make the bet on this technology, then we are sure that we are creating a large N for the network in the future. And, you know, get a bet on Metcalfe's law. Maintain complexibility is one of the things that you have to take into account when you do innovation. Make sure you lower the price. So maintain lower complexity. Make sure the tools are available. We've been working hard on developing tools to make DNSSEC easier. The story of this morning, how good it was, the double key rollover and the EPP, all the key rollover stories, normal users shouldn't have to be bothered with that. That should live in tools. If people are exposed to it, they will make the decision to walk away. So that's about the ripeness of the innovation. And finally, the knowledge about the innovation. The knowledge of the innovation spreads best in people with the shared values. The DNS community is a bit of a clique. And within the TLD community, we've seen the spread, but we haven't seen it yet in the enterprises. And that's because there is probably a different set of values, a different set of communication skills. We have not reached out into those areas. Once that happens and the word spreads, I think we're fine. But you have to have a convincing message. Now, maybe that convincing message is added benefit. And that, I think, with 16 seconds to go, is a very natural bridge into Dane. Thank you.
It is, actually, a natural bridge into Dane. Except that I had decided I was going to have Joe talk about the root zone KSK trust anchor retrieval. But thank you, Olaf, for that tour of things, because I think you're absolutely right. And it's one of the questions that we have in this workshop is what is the message? You know, we've talked about that before. What's the killer app? What's the reason, the business driver? And part of what we'll talk about here with Dane in particular is a very real value that we can be talking to people about. Before we get to a trio of presentations related to Dane, though, Joe would like to talk a bit about the Root Zone KSK Trust Anchor. So I will pass that to you.
Hello again. So this is going to be quite quick. I'll leave more time for other people to talk about the more interesting things. But I guess one of the aspects of whether or not we have a platform on which we can innovate is whether or not people are using it. And the rate at which people download a trust anchor for the root zone turns out to be an indicator of the pervasiveness of the potential for validation, even if it's not happening now. So as I say, only 8 slides, so we shall skip through them fairly quickly. To start with, let's make sure we understand what we're talking about. We've had several presentations earlier today talking about this chain of trust being built through DNS keys and corresponding DSRR sets. I mean, everybody here is familiar, I'm sure, with that process. If you want to have people be able to trust a DNS key, a KSK that you're publishing, then you publish a DS in your parent. And that works for every zone in the DNS apart from one, which is the root zone, because the root zone has no parent. So there is nowhere to publish a DS record for the root zone KSK. We have to find some way of transmitting that information to validators out of band. It's the bootstrapping mechanism for a validator. It's the one piece of information they need in order to be able to trust the entire system, or at least the subset of the system that's not broken on any particular day. So the way we do this, now read this specification with a generous mind, because at the time we designed this, there was no validation going on. There was no trust anchor being downloaded in any systematic way. And our approach was really to publish this thing in as many ways as we could think of. It's not obvious that we've yet found the correct way, which is partly why I'm here, is to encourage conversation and say, what is a better way? Or is one of these ways better than the others? So we publish an XML document. And the XML document, the schema, is published. The XML document contains information about the inception date and the date at which you should stop trusting this key. It contains the hash of the root zone KSK. And that XML document itself is variously signed with PGP and SMIME. Now, that sounds very good, but in fact, the PGP key that it's signed with is not the easiest key in the world to trust. If you happen to be able to trust my PGP key, or Rick Lamb's PGP key, or Kim Davies' PGP key, possibly yours, then you have a way of trusting that signature. Otherwise, you're kind of out of luck. It's not an especially global way of doing this. It's also signed with an SMIME certificate, which is derived from an ICANN CA, which is largely unpublished, and nobody has any way to trust it. So there are deficiencies in some of these things. These are works in progress. We publish a PKCS 11 CSR, the kind of thing that you would normally send to a CA in order to attract a certificate so that people could trust your key. And we do this because it is effectively signed with the KSK itself. It's proof of possession of the private part of the KSK. People have told us that this is useful. We also have a certificate, which is that CSR processed by the same ICANN CA that nobody else can trust because it's a private CA. Not especially useful. And we serve this thing over both HTTP and also HTTPS. So there's some transport security available, which, you know, as long as you trust, I think, the GoDaddy certificate that's used for that certificate, then you have at least some knowledge that the transport is as secure as, well, you have an expectation of security to some degree. Next slide. So what we saw after we went live in July 2010 was a dribble of downloads from this thing. We saw a lot of spiders. We saw a lot of people trying to retrieve ../..././/.////etc/password and things like that. Various long SQL strings and all kinds of other interesting sort of nonsense that you see just by having a web server on the internet. We also saw some actual downloads of the Trust Anchor. And in particular, when NLNet Labs added the unbound anchor script to Unbound, the popular validating resolver, we would see Unbound quite frequently downloading. We would see literally hundreds, perhaps even 150, maybe 1,000 downloads per month from Unbound. And again, we're not expecting that to reflect on the deployment of Unbound. This is a thing you do once, pretty much, when you install Unbound, and every time you upgrade it, you don't do it again. So we didn't expect a massive volume, but it was reasonable. And NLNet Labs were one of the early sets of people who actually were interested in how to do this.
You now have a mechanism to measure popularity for Unbound. I never knew that.
Well, I'm about to tell you that it's much less popular than the iPhone. So not long ago, I forget exactly which release it was. I think it might have been 6.0 or 6.1 or something like that. But there was a new release of the iPhone operating system released, following which I had a call from the security department that said, oh, IT are on the phone. They think we might be being attacked. And we were trying to find out what was going on, and we found a large amount of activity on this web server, all with the same user agent, all corresponding to one of the methods within iOS that you use to retrieve things over HTTP. And in fact, what we were seeing was a marked increase in the amount, number of downloads of these things because of iPhones. We were effectively tracking the sales and upgrade curve for Apple. Next slide. So if you look at this, you see zeros on the bottom. That's not zeros. That's very significant, valuable contributions from NLNet Labs. And then on the scale, you can see the curve quickly rises to 2.4 billion per month, which is what it was last month.
So all of you become noise.
Damn jobs.
Have I been off the whole time? No. Okay, good. Oh, I see. Okay. All right. Whack-a-mole. So, yes, 2.4 billion a month was the last one. This graph at the beginning is meaningless now because there's way too many iPhones. So I have the next graph with a log scale, so you can at least see there's some sort of shape to it. It doesn't necessarily mean an awful lot, but those are the numbers. And again, this is a log scale, so the fact that it says 10 billion at the top is not actually mean that we have 10 billion downloads right now. We have 2.4. That's the way that where it works, is log that. Next one. So we still have some work to do. We understand that we have some work to do with this. We now have at least one platform that's widely retrieving this thing. If you're interested in why it's doing it, I suppose you'd have to talk to Apple, but certainly from our side we can tell you that it's happening because you recognize the user agent. So next things to happen, just briefly, we're going to progress the discussion of how we publish the Trust Anchor and how we enable a secure access to the Trust Anchor, particularly for embedded devices. Is it clockwork? Is it? Okay, I'll just keep talking. So we have some work to do on the Trust Anchor specification. Jacob and I have been working on that for some time. We're going to pick that up again in the IETF, in DNS op. And it's related. And a related draft discusses how a validator can bootstrap itself, clean out of the box, and have a reasonable mechanism for downloading a trust anchor and trusting it. So we think devices that have no operator, or at least no skilled operator, such as an iPhone, because we know that the skill level of iPhone users is very low compared to, obviously, Android phones.
Okay.
I believe that's it.
Thank you, Joe.
Yep, you're welcome.
And you'll notice that your microphone is being cut off right about the two-minute interval when it went over there, you know, so, but...
I told you I'd be quick.
Well, yes, no, and that was good. I love that slide. That'll be something I think will be good candidate for a blog post. So I want to move into a collection of short little presentations around Dane. And actually, in reviewing the items, I think what I'm going to do is have I'm going to go and then with a brief thing, and then Jakob's presentation actually fits nicely with mine, talking a bit about how the two connect together, and then we'll have. Russ and Heiko talk about their elements of pieces as well. So let me begin with just how many people have heard of the Dane protocol? So why are we doing these presentations? All right. Okay. Well, we're pretty much. Okay, we're done in a few slides. All right. So, well, then let's just go ahead. I'll advance quickly on these. So I'm here with the Internet Society with the Deploy 360. How many people have heard of the Deploy 360 program? All right. Now everybody has. Okay, good. We'll move on. Well, we're providing deployment information about IPv6 and DNSSEC. All right. So for the people who are on and for the record here, the primary thing we're looking at is, or one of the questions we have is, why do I need DNSSEC if I already have SSL, especially if I've paid for a very expensive EVSSL? Why do I need this? And we go back to the typical web interaction. We get our cute little lock icon down there. And the question is this encrypted with the correct certificate? Because there could be somebody else in the way. It could be a firewall, it could be an attacker, it could be somebody else, a middle box that is breaking it in some manner and then providing a re-signed certificate back, which could be a valid re-sign, it could be a self-signed, it could be something and is somehow the user is clicking through it so that they get their nice little lock icon and they think they're happy and everything is good. But it's in fact the wrong certificate. And in the meanwhile, the firewall or other middle device is going out there. And this is actually more common than we think out there. And it's being done in some cases by middle boxes, by Wi-Fi cafes, by other hotels, other places, things in places where this is actually somewhat common out there. And so what we're looking at, the general problem with the certificate authority environment is that there are so many of them. Some estimates are now around 1,500 CAs by the time you get into the resellers and the other chain that are down there. There's, 50-something root certificates in most of the browsers, but then there are the resellers down below them that are there. And so what we're talking about is combining the encryption that comes with TLS with the strong integrity that you get from DNSSEC and putting those together to be Dane. And the question has come up, how do you do this? And you store either the full certificate or a fingerprint of the certificate into this new record called the TLSA record. Now you can do a DNSSEC validation on this to verify that this is in fact the correct one. And we can see that in here with a Dane equipped browser, it would go down and it would pull down from DNS the additional records, the DNS key and the RRSIGs, but also this TLSA record that's there. And if a Dane-equipped browser, we could talk about that in a minute, if it would do that, it would then be able to say this does not validate correctly. Now, Dane is not just for the web. There are also people using it, and I know Jakob's going to point to a couple of drafts and talk about it for email. There's some folks looking at it for even some uses in VoIP and Jabber. So it's a general mechanism for putting certificate information into DNS. I'll put these up there for the slides are available. We have a page with resources at Deploy360. It has a great number of information and some test sites and other pieces out in that. We'll talk a bit about how we get Dane out there in larger areas, and I'll leave you with a couple of tips around this. From the hosting, from developers, we need people who are developers starting to implement Dane and doing it in some ways. I did an interview recently at IETF with Emil Lavol, who's put DNSSEC actually through some funding from NLNet Labs into his Jitsi soft phone. Oh, sorry, the Internet Foundation, you're right, sorry, who put it into his Jitsi soft phone so he could be able to do VoIP and use DNSSEC to secure the records associated with that. We need to have more of that kind of thing happening. On the DNS hosting provider side, we need to provide a mechanism for entering TLSA records and for allowing those to happen. And we'll talk about a couple of tools coming up in one of the next presentations. And network operators and folks who are using it, we need to be starting to use it. We'll talk about a tool here. Russ will be talking about a specific tool people can use. And we also need to talk to the browser vendors and have them to, you know, encourage them to get this out there. It really provides a way to upgrade the security of what we're doing out there. So with that, I'm going to leave mine and move into, I think we should move into Jakob. And I'll wait on questions until we do a couple of these, and we'll take the Dane questions all together.
So I've titled my talk here, How to Use DNSSEC to Keep PKI on a Leash, and yes, you can just continue. So this is me, Jakob. I've done this for a while, IT contributor and such. Next slide. So the question is, why does PKI need to be kept on a leash? Next slide.
I don't know if your mic's on.
It isn't? One, two, yes. It's red here. This is PKI. Next slide. Problem one. Oh, yes, that's the normal reaction to PKI. Problem number one, any universally trusted, like WebTrust, PKIX, certification authority can issue any certificate to anyone. There are something called name constraints where you could limit the amount of damage a CA could do and what certificates it can issue. They are not in wide use nor widely implemented. When there is CA malpractice, there is something does something bad, not to mention anyone, especially. It's very hard to mitigate, and there are attacks happening. I mean, either for lawful interception purposes or in some other purposes or just because you can, and they're happening today and maybe even here. We don't really know, and you don't know either, actually. Next. The second problem is that the current CA model effectively puts a tax on enabling secure communications. One might think that there are certificates which a lower or down to zero cost. There are normal domain validated certificates below down to like $12 per host. But it's still a cost, and it's still a considerable effort to deploy certificates on, say, 1,000 hosts in a network. And extended validation, of course, which you can add validation and add stuff like the company name to a certificate, that adds cost even more. Next. So the goal is to have something that enables path restrictions to limit the amount of damage a single CA can do, and to use DNSSEC for identity validation. And that could be that we do PKI without the traditional CA structure, but it could also be just an assistant to limit the damage. Next. So the idea was that if DNS is used for identity proofing, and DNSSEC provides data origin authentication, why involve the third party, the CA? So is this a new idea? No, of course it's not. It's began back in 1999. If you read the cert RFC very thoroughly, you can find text that this is actually, you can think this is what they meant. Continuing, back in 2002, I wrote this draft about combining PKIX and DNS. The PKIX working group were not really amused. We had to leave the room. But then things passed, and the number of attacks on CAs and such increased, and DNSSEC actually starting to take off. So we ended up at Dane, DNS-based authentication of named entities. Next slide. We are now on RFC 6698, where we can bind keys to domains using DNS. So this is how it looks. We have the normal PKS hierarchy, where we have a trustworthy, nice CA like diginotar.nl, which signs the host www.example.com, and we can add to this the DNSSEC hierarchy, which has the root, the com, example.com, and then we add a link using TLSA, which is the Dane resource record. Next. So we can provide two functions here. We have the CA lock, where TLSA, which is the record, enumerates acceptable CA certificates that we allow to use to sign certificates to this domain. And this protects against CA malpractice. The second use, next slide, is certificate lock, where we lock down to a specific certificate that you should expect on this host. Still, we use traditional PKIX. We could use extended validation and such. Next. We could also use self-signed certificates and have Dane verify those and enable TLS without depending on existing PKIX. Next. And to compare these two, we have authentication, which is DNS in both cases for domain validation certificates and for Dane, of course, either using email usually for PKIX and DNS for DNS, Dane. We have revocation, where we have OCSP or CRLs for PKI, and for Dane we have DNS, of course, and then we have the same validation engine, which is PKIX with the rules and stuff. Next. So we have some sort of consensus. We have code. So next. The implementation we've seen today there are some number of Dane utilities. We have Swede, which is, of course, you need a Swede to make a Dane. And we have sorry about that. This is actually written by Dutch, so I'm not involved in this at all. We have Hashlinger, which is another. This is just command line tools. We have something which looks very promising. We have PostFix with Dane support. So we have PostFix, which actually does full certificate validation using Dane. Really nice. And we have an effort from the Swedish University Network and Nordnet, where they have sponsored implementation of Dane in OpenSSL, which will be available in the core OpenSSL distribution later this year. So future work, and I know I'm out of time. Never mind. We need to look at last mile security, and this is something that people have been talking about a lot, of course. And is it realistic to be able to do DNS validation in the end host? We have middle boxes and whatnot that trying to mess with our packets. And can we get the DNSSEC data to someone behind such filtering infrastructure? There have been interesting proposals to like tunnel DNS using certificates or HTTP or what have you. And we need to look more on that. And the only way we can look at it is to try. So I'm hoping that there will be support that in the future for those of us who are not on an open network. Next. We're also looking at Dane for S/MIME. Paul Hoffman and I have a draft in the working group currently where we describe how to do just Dane, but for S/MIME instead. So we take the email address and tinker it around a bit, and then suddenly it looks like DNS, and we do Dane, as you would expect. Yes. This is my email address, by the way.
Excellent. Well, I think that's a good review or a good overview of what's looking at that for further innovation. Olaf, you look like you have a comment. So,
Olaf Colin, one shameless plug and one comment. I think it's very valuable to point out that if you think about registration authorities that are used in certificates, and you think about PKIX in general, then all validation is done based on domain names. And if you then think about what are the registration authorities for domain names, you end up with not certificate authorities in the way that we know them, but the registries that are walking around here. So it's a very natural alignment of the model and a good set of shared shared fate.
Just one side comment to that: in the PKIX world, if you just buy a certificate and you start trusting these web trust guys, you actually have to trust everyone the same. And the good thing with DNS and the people here is that if you start trusting, for example, .se and I have used something with .se. I only trust .se and below, and yep. no one else. So it's the path restrictions are very important, the property of this.
And the second one was the shameless plug. You said trying the last mile, and look for DNSSEC trigger. If you're interested in trying that last mile and you're a little bit tech-savvy, at the Nelnet Labs we made a little tool that you can download and install on your machinery that gives you, for Windows, for Mac, and for Linux, an unbound install with some configuration magic around it that will allow you to do DNSSEC validation on your local host. And that's the type of experiment that people need to do when they're roaming. So laptop users, be warned, that's not production ready. You need to be a little bit tech savvy to know how to turn it off.
You do, because you wind up getting into places where you do have to turn it off. I run it on my laptop, and it's very good. We're also going to be talking about one other tool. Russ is going to be coming up in a few minutes to talk about another tool that does the last mile right directly in a browser environment. But first, we're going to have Heiko Zhang and talk a bit about Dane and innovation from the CNNIC perspective.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everybody here. And I'm Heiko Zhang from CNNIC. Let's talk about the Dane and the innovation. Next slide, please. Okay. Okay, thank you very much. And as you know, DNSSEC can build a secure platform in DNS architecture. It is very hard for hackers to forge a DNS package in DNS service if all of us deploy the DNSSEC, because all of resource records should be verified in the resolver side. So I think in the future, more and more security sensitive resource record can be published in DNS systems. TLC is such a kind of resource record which needed to be published under the DNSSEC protection. Dane is a virtually a shortcut to launch a public key or CA certificate for the companies who provide online service. And DNSSEC can protect the TLC resource record from the man-in-the-middle attack. Take, for example, Kaminsky. It's very famous. Yeah. Next one. Okay. But the DNS is not perfect because it is very vulnerable to the DDoS attack, like under amplification attack. So if you want to deploy the TLC, you'd better to choose another solutions to handle this issue. CNNIC has developed an anti-DDoS device, which is hardware, and he can monitor the DNS traffic and block the invalid package to protect our DNS service. We have another functionality. It's very cool. This device has an emergency cache, which can store the TLC resource record and other related resource record temporarily if our device finds the backend name DNS service crashed. Our device will give a reply to the queries automatically. And this device can improve the stability for your DNS service. As you know, CN has deployed, developed software about the DNS key rollover. I said this afternoon, and the TLC rotation is look like the DNS key rollover. So we Scenic will integrate the TLC rotation into our systems. Then if this work has finished, the TLC resource record will be very easy to deploy for our customers. I want to say internet is not perfect currently, because some old network equipment may affect the reachability for bigger DNSSEC package. TLC and DNSSEC is may larger than 512 bits. This is bad news, and because this package, because the queries may fail, if the package is transmitted from the old equipment, so Scenic has developed a monitor system which covers the most area in mainland of China. If any TLC will invisible in some area, in some different place, this monitor system will give us a warning. Then our operators will trace the DNS package and find the reason why the TLC record is invisible in the DNS systems. I think these tools can benefit our customers, but there is a requisite that our customers must submit his information to our system, then we can monitor it. Okay, that's all.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Let's go now to Russ Mundy to talk about one of those solutions that can go and really provide an end-user solution for the last mile. And then after that, we'll throw it open to a few brief questions. So if you've got a question for any of the panelists related to Dane, please get ready to think about them because we'll have a couple of minutes.
Thanks, Dan. Yeah, we'll go through this quickly, but I think it's one of the more exciting things that we've done recently. Next slide. We've had the DNSSEC-capable browser that will validate every name that shows up on the page for many years. What we've done is migrated it forward to where we've rebranded it. It's now called Bloodhound, and it also does the Dane protocol as part of the DNSSEC processing, or in addition to the DNSSEC processing. Of course, there's a ton of other tools that won't talk about at all today, but in the shameless plug era, please feel free to look at the tool site. They literally are all free. They're all open source. They're all available. We maintain a users list so we can answer any questions that you have. Next. And this is a picture of Dan's Deploy 360 with the Dane test sites on it on the Bloodhound browser. We have, we think, kind of a cute little puppy dog that I was thinking about showing, but I thought Dane, the Dane test page would be good. One of the things that we have seen is there are a couple of sites that should validate that actually don't, and this is representation of early implementations of the Dane protocol. It's normal, but please give it a try, and let us know if you see some things that don't work or you want to have them changed. But this will literally do DNSSEC right down to your machine. It's my default browser today that I'm using. And it will also, of course, verify the Dane protocol, self-signed or otherwise, self-signed source or otherwise. Next. And this is one of my favorite slides. This is how many lookups it takes. This is drawn with one of the other tools from DNSSEC tools to actually resolve from an empty resolver those two websites. And they're big commercial websites, but it gives you an idea of how many DNS lookups there are on some of these big commercial sites. Next. So this is the DNSSEC deployment website, and if you look there, you can see the DNS checkmark. That was a way that we came up with to actually illustrate in a more visible way, besides just down in the corner, that you are getting DNSSEC validation, and it's the construct of the page that allows us to show the green checkmark. Next, please. And this one, you see, has the warning sign. And if you take a look at the first story on the page, this is actually a screenshot of a live demonstration where we did a DNS hijack. And the screen you saw before was the actual correct page with DNSSEC validation. This is what you would get on that page with one of the links hijacked that was in the middle of the page. So it's not just an entire page that you can hijack. You can hijack just one or two or three links on the page. Next, please. And so when you see the bloodhound frame here on the left, that's the regular Firefox. On the right, it's Bloodhound. And you'll see there's a little add-on in addition to the regular DNSSEC validation that will give you an indication of having blocked or detected some non-validating names on the page. Next. And doing the same lookup to the same page, there's another tool that we've found really helps people have an idea more what's going on with DNSSEC, and that's it will actually visually draw from a log file a picture of what's being validated, what its state is, what's failing validation. In other words, all the DNS lookups and all their states are illustrated for you on the page, and that's an actual live screenshot of all the lookups from root down to www.dnssectools.org. Next. Next. That's it? Okay. I thought I had one more. Okay. Well, anyway, that's it. So back
okay.
to Dan.
So, and we can say you can go to the dnssec-tools.org to go and download Bloodhound. It's available there. Unfortunately, I think we are out of time because we have 20 minutes left in the session and we need to talk about the public key rollover. Are there any quick questions that people have about Dane? What I'm going to say is I think we should probably move on to the final platform for things. Before we do that, I'll say that all of us who are here can talk about Dane with anybody when the session ends in 20 minutes. And also, I would also mention we have Warren Kamari, who's here, who's one of the co-chairs of the Dane Working Group within the IETF, and so he will also be available. So let's thank this panel. And we've got both co-chairs of the Dane Working Group, right? No? Oh, the author of the Dane, of RFC 6698, right?
Which is much more impressive than useful.
All right. Okay. So anyway, with that, let's thank our panelists, and let's look for our next group. Come on up, Yop.
Two of you can, yeah. Yop, come on up.
Isn't he cute?
Always cute. All right, I wasn't showing my slides yet for no good reason at all. So let me first pull up. Oh, wrong one.
Okay, well, we've heard several references today of various kinds of key rollover and how's it going to happen and how's it going to be done. There's one really important one that hasn't had too much direct mention today, but in fact there is an open ICANN request for consultation and input on it that closes Friday, so there's the topic. Rollover of the root zone KSK. So if folks have comments and thoughts and previously were unaware of that request for input. Please look at it as soon as possible, and if you have something you want to contribute, please send it in so that ICANN knows what your thoughts are on it. So I think let's go to Joe and get started there.
Okay. I'm going to try and test myself now, see if I can not go over 5 minutes. So let's skip ahead. There we go. So these slides that just give a little bit of background about the operations involved in managing the root zone KSK. We already mentioned in the previous presentation it's the one KSK rollover that is difficult because there is no parent to put a DS record in. So we're effectively trying to find a way to change the configuration of all validators in the world when we don't know who they are. So it's a challenge. So the consultation document, when you go to ICANN's webpage and look for public comment, you'll find it, and there's a document there that outlines most of these bullet points in with more words. But I'll run through them really quite quickly. We have one KSK that is active right now. It was generated in Ceremony 1. It was then transported in a secure fashion in multiple key shares and tamper-evident bags and things across the country. It was imported into HSMs in Ceremony 2 on the other side of the U.S., at which point it was considered in production. And it went into production and was published in July 2010. It's physically stored in four HSMs, two on the east coast of the U.S. and two on the west coast. And we use that KSK four times a year, in every case in a ceremony where we have webcasts so people can watch. We have third parties not employed by VeriSign, ICANN, or NTIA that participate within the ceremony. People are familiar with this stuff. I won't go on too much about it. Next slide. So just to reiterate, just to sort of amplify the aspects of stuff we've already done that are ready for a rollover, when we did the transition in July 2010, when we pulled the dress off the DERS because we obscured the keys to start with to make sure there was no early validation, we did that as a key rollover. So the software that's used in the key ceremonies to produce the signatures that VeriSign then uses to publish the root zone already accommodates KSK rollovers. This has been done. It's tested. The source code is available, and in fact, the DVD image that contains the source and the binaries, you can download it, and you can dissect it to your heart's content. It's based on CentOS. Data.iana.org is where it's published. So anytime we use the KSK, we have a ceremony. I've mentioned we have four ceremonies, but we can skip past this one. So what is the impact of a KSK rollover? If you are a zone administrator, if you're a TLD administrator or administrator of any other zone, you don't care. It has no impact on you at all. Not directly impact on your operations for signing your zone. The root zone partners, the VeriSign, NTIA, and ICANN, who together provide access to TLDs for publishing information in the root zone, there's no change required there. But for this unknown, difficult to enumerate, massive, potentially global set of validators, there is an impact. Because if you don't change your configuration, then suddenly as soon as the old key disappears, or the signatures from the old key disappears, your customers suddenly see the DNS go dark. And then the support phone rings red, and that tiny 6 cents of margin you had for that DSL customer this month is gone. Next slide. So to mitigate this, we follow the timing specified in RFC 5011. We don't specify we don't follow the letter of everything in that RFC, but we certainly follow the timing. We set the revoke bit on the outgoing key, and we have tested that a validator that supports 5011 today that has bugs fixed that were found during the testing, which is all any release in the last 2 years, will follow 5011 and will survive a role of the KSK if it follows these timing parameters, which our software does do. So there is some expectation and hope that any software that supports 5011 will survive a KSK role. Next slide. We also support the publication of every KSK that there has ever been, clearly marked with when they should be trusted and the date and time at which they should stop being trusted in this XML document that we saw iPhones downloading in their billions in the previous presentation. So at the moment, that XML document contains exactly one KSK because that's the full set of KSKs that have ever been. Once we do a roll, there will be another one in there, and the old KSK will remain in there but clearly marked as do not use. As far as the commitments that we have, the KSK management is done as an IANA function under contract with the U.S. Department of Commerce, And the contract that we have specifies that we will roll the key within 5 years of continuous operation, which means sometime before July 2015. And with this background, the main reason for being here and mentioning this and really having this panel is that we have a public comment open right now. It doesn't close until the 13th, I think, of this month.
I thought it was the 12th.
It might be the 12th. Okay, it's in UTC. I think it depends what time of the dateline you're on. But there are a few days remaining for people to send comments. There are a number of comments already there. They don't have to be formatted in a fancy way. We have comments from individuals as well as organizations. And really, anybody that has an interest in this is encouraged to find the public comment page on the ICANN front page and to read what's already there and submit your own thoughts before it closes. And by the way, it's perfectly valid to say, I need more time for this. In which case, it's entirely possible that if we think there's a reason to extend the comment period for another few weeks, everything is possible. We're just keen to hear from everybody we can. I believe that's it. Is there one more? Oh, there we go. 13th of April is when it closed. On the 7th of April, which is when I did my slides, several weeks after they were due, there were 8 responses received. It's not a lot, but they are from some interesting people, and they contain some good content. So, like I say, if you have an opinion, please submit a comment.
Okay, thanks, Joe. There's also been some action going on in the ICANN Security and Stability Advisory Committee. There's a work party that's discussing this issue, and Jaap Ankerhaus is one of the members of the work party. So we've asked Jaap to say a few questions about where that work is at.
And that's me. Yes, and I was hoping to tell more, to be able to tell more than I can. On the moment, but basically, I mean, we've been thinking about the rollover and problems since last year or so, and it's been on the back burner for a while, and we're actually now getting more work done on trying to get, I mean, basically what we want to do is to explore the problem space, not just going over some small parts and getting into details, but trying to get coherent pictures of what can be happen, what you do on what things. And as Patrick has said in various public meetings, I mean, working groups don't necessarily produce any results and or recommendations, and the plan is present a report where we go through a couple of scenarios, really like things people don't think about, or and see maybe some other ways of doing the rollover, because some suggestion pops up, not doing 5.11 or a different variant, you know, things like that, and we'll see what's going to happen. And so actually it's more to help to structure the discussion than to actually say this is the best way to do stuff. So that's basically what our plans are on the moment. And again, we had some delay, so there's not a lot more I can say about this. But we're very interested in what's happening on the public forum and what will be being said there. We will have a good look at what's going to happen. And that's basically all I can say on the moment.
Thank you, Jaap. Well, right now, we actually made up enough of our time that we have we have 5 minutes for questions here, and then we've got a few closing slides that Dan and I will go over.
Thanks, Jay Daly. I won't be commenting because I think we're at the stage now where all of the things that you end up suggesting doing are just the right things to do, and my only comment would be, yeah, great. But I do have a question, though, which is, did you consider any clever things along the lines of DERS that would enable us in a sort of live way to test some of what's actually going to happen? For example, doing a 5011 rollover to exactly the same key.
That's interesting. The quick answer is no. We have not had any clever thoughts whatsoever. We're only having stupid thoughts. I guess the position we're coming from, really, and the questions that are in the consultation that are actually asked are not just should we do this, or even really how should we do this. The other important aspects are things like, what notice should we give? How do we announce that this thing is going to happen? How do we draw attention to the people in operator communities? Perhaps that's easy. People who don't normally go to NZNOG, NANOG, APRICOT meetings, how do we reach all these other people? Do we take out adverts in the New York Times and other major newspapers in different regions? Or, you know, what do we do to draw people's attention to the fact that this is coming? There's a question of how often we do the role and when we do the first one, and whether when we do the first one, we follow it with another one quickly and then slow down, or we have some other rhythm to it. There's the question of, once we do the first role, how do we even know if something broke? Because things break on the internet all day, every day. We can't have a good way necessarily of knowing when things break. We have no giant red telephone that all ISPs have a copy of that they can call us and tell us when things break. So these ancillary questions are also worth asking. But I mean, I think the idea of rolling to the same key is an interesting one. But I'm not. We'd have to think harder about exactly what that would prove in practice. Yeah.
So, Warren Kumari, seeing as I have the mic. So, as time goes by, more people do validation. So, therefore, the number of affected parties increases. Eventually, we're going to have to do this, so maybe we should do it soon. Other people have already said this. Is it useful to submit a contribution basically saying plus one? You know, I agree with all the other comments. Let's just do this now.
There's no harm in it. I mean, absolutely. I mean, if you have two thoughts and you're uncertain, I would say err on the side of posting.
Yeah. And also, I mean, there are people who are coming up with, why would you roll at all? And, I mean, these are also valuable questions. And, I mean, if you're going to roll over, must have a reason. Or if you don't roll over, you also must have, you know, motivation of doing that. And that's part, it will come up in the discussion, so it's better to have that early in the discussion than late.
Dan York, I would just second that. I think that we need to, you know, the message that I've heard from the folks at ICANN and from Joe and others is that they want as many comments. And I've asked that of others, too. Do you want basically a plus one? And so, yeah, I will be submitting a comment that is more or less a plus one of some other comments that are in there, you know, phrased to be a little bit more than plus one. But more or less the same thing as far as saying that I think we need to roll it. We need to roll it on a periodic basis, and we need to do that to at least figure out what's broken right now, and break it now and break it and fix it so we can make sure we don't break it when we need to. Because maybe we'll never need to do an emergency rollover of the KSK. Hopefully we never will. But who knows? And so it would be better to prepare for that. So I would encourage everybody in this room to go take a look at that public consultation. And there are comments. You can read the comments that are there. There's a very easy link to go and click on those and see what's already been submitted. And you know, send it in. It's a simple email. That's all you have to do.
Actually, I think the observation that a scheduled role, one of the reasons for a scheduled role is to practice a procedure that hopefully can be used in an emergency, I think that's a great observation. I try very hard not to have opinions on these things because I feel like, I don't know, I should just be quiet and listen. But I agree with that. I think that's a great idea. There are some people who have suggested that rolling the key at all is a mistake. And I think the only reasonable answer to that is to say, well, we cannot expect the key to last for an infinite amount of time. I mean, cryptographers disagree about the plausible lifetime of a key of a particular algorithm, but none of them say that it's going to last forever. So there's going to have to be a roll at some point. So it's not really a question of should we roll, it's a question of how do we roll, and these various ancillary questions that go around it.
Anton Vuren, one of the questions I have is to be able to advise correctly on what the things are that you need to take in consideration. I need to know how the network really looks like. I need to know how the network really looks like, and I'm sort of like missing that information. Is there, for example, a complete test environment where you can test and do things? How is that set up? For example, we do key rollover testing on a complete copy of our production system, and that's how we keep in shape in getting the knowledge in-house. When you have that, you don't need to do that in production.
So it's a little bit different the way we do things because the responsibility for signing the zone is split between two parties, which is unusual. I mean, I have not heard of another zone where you have one ZSK manager and one KSK manager and they're separate people. But that's what we have in the root zone. So we don't actually do any zone signing ourselves at ICANN. We receive from VeriSign every ceremony what's called a KSR. It's a key signing request, which is effectively a whole series of DNS key RR sets with timing parameters for when the signature should start and when it should expire. And that we validate that fits the policy, and then we generate those signatures using the HSM, and we produce a corresponding file. It's an XML document that contains all those signatures. VeriSign go back that back. They stick that into one end of the sausage machine, and then every twice a day, a new root zone comes out with the appropriate signatures in it. So what we have really are all the tools that we use in the ceremony are published. Anybody could download those things, make an SKR, the spec, the design for which is published, and they could inspect what happens and say, well, if we set the KSK role bit and we incorporate a new key, does the SKR look reasonable? Do we have the correct periods in there?
So is it viable to sort of like copy that complete installation and procedure for a test run?
Absolutely, and we have done many test runs, and these things happen as part of the QA every time we change the tools. But just to be clear, the only infrastructure you need to emulate a key ceremony is a laptop and a copy of the DVD to boot off.
Let me add a little more, Andre. And the problem is not the mechanism for actually doing it. Okay, that's been fairly extensively tested and run a number of times in the real world, and I think you've tested it besides. So the big problem in this instance is what happens and what are the impacts elsewhere. Away from the place where the change occurs, it's throughout the internet. What's going to happen? What do people think? And how do we find out about things that were problematic? Okay, it's different than every other zone in that manner, because it's not just you, it's the whole internet. Okay, one more and then we'll do our quick little wrap up.
Yes, I think this information out to the internet is very, very important. And that will be the key of success of key rollover. And I think that ICANN must plan for a massive information campaign out to everyone.
ICANN could always use the same way that they've warned everybody about the new GTLDs.
Oh, Warren. Okay, thanks Joe, thanks Jop, appreciate it very much.
Go ahead, I've been talking a while.
Alright, so you've now been here for about 6.5 hours, I think, in some way. We've talked a lot about DNSSEC, we've heard about trends, Warren's getting tired up here, we've heard about the trends that are out there, we've heard about where it's happening in Asia Pacific, we've talked about tools, we've talked about all sorts of things, and so we want to just, first of all, thank you all for coming here, and many of you I've seen have been sitting here this entire time, and so thank you very much, I would say, for coming here and being part of this. And the question we really have is, how do we extend that beyond this, and what can we do to make more of this happen? And so Russ and I have a couple final little moments to say, and you can move on down here. We've divided this up into three different areas, really, and one thing we'd like to say is, how many of you are TLD operators here? Okay. What? Oh, okay. So I think you've heard again and again, you know, the critical component of planning it out, looking at what's here. We need to have those domains signed. Those need to be signed out there. You need to accept DS records. You know, that's the first part. Sign it, then make that happen. The other key component, which we didn't really talk about here today, is registrars. It's a key component we need to work with those registrars to make it easy for registrants to enable DNSSEC or to do something on that line, because that is a missing gap that we have. And then, you know, we talked earlier, we saw the folks who from SIDN who were talking about gathering statistics Vim from Center talk about statistics there. We'd really like to see help from the TLD operators in how they can help generate statistics and make it more available with that. So we really call on the TLD operators to make this work. Do you want to?
Sure. for the zone operators, because even if you're not a TLD operator, you probably have some zones you operate, whether you're an enterprise or a person or whatever. Sign it today. Whether or not you get your DS record in your parent, that's something you need to do eventually, but the first step is sign your zones. Start using tools, start doing it, and contribute to the statistics collection, whether it's some of the individual things like the DNSSEC check like we have in our toolkit, the statistics that the SIDN folks are doing, or Steve Crocker's TLD statistic collections. It's valuable to let people know what's going on.
And on the validation side, you know, network service providers, ISPs, all of those, the second half of this, which we talked a little bit about at the beginning, is we need to get more validation happening out there. It's certainly happening in some spaces with some ISPs, some countries and some places are doing it. There's a very easy, you know, most of the validating, the DNS resolvers out there, you know, now have the steps to turn on DNSSEC validation very simply and easily. You can do it in, you know, one line in Bind. You can do it in Microsoft Windows Server 2012. You can do it in the in Unbound. You know, the tools are out there very easily to go and do the validations there. It's a simple spec. So we would really encourage anybody out there, enterprises, ISPs, anyone, to look at deploying DNSSEC validating DNS resolvers, signing your domains, and again, we'll put in a plug down there, promoting support of Dane. You know, we didn't have a lot of chance to talk about some of the more business aspects of what Dane provides, but it does allow us to go out and talk to people about a very real value of upgrading the security of the internet and upgrading the security of the e-commerce solutions and the SSL TLS certificates networks that we use. And Dane is that step that can seriously provide real business value to organizations if it is out there and deployed. And so we need to get Dane out there. We need to have people using TLSA. We need to be, you know, creating TLSA records, and we need to have applications and others that are validating it. So really, we're asking all of you to help out with that. And, oh, okay. Well, so we sort of did this one, too, as far as signing your domains, promoting Dane in some way. And then also, if you're within an enterprise, you know, again, talk to your IT team. Do whatever you can to get validation happening out there.
And everybody, pick up the free tools. Have fun. Play with them. Use them. Experiment yourself. Put them on your machine. Carry them around with you. Whether it's a Bloodhound, DNSSEC Trigger, some of us have a whole bunch of them that we walk around with and use them all the time. And get it in your own hands, because pretty much everybody in this room is able to download software that's available from these sites. Just pick it up and give it a try, and give feedback to folks, that whether it's the producers or people in the standards world, or, you know, join in mailing lists. And I wanted to just take the last little bit to say thank you, especially to all the presenters. It's a lot of work for all of the people that bring things here and put them together. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I think that's.
And we'll see you next time, I hope, at least. Well, instead of
so one last thing to mention, there's some sites you can go to learn about more about this. There's the dnssecdeployment.org, which has a number of different resources. There's our Deploy 360 portal, which has a great amount, and the DNSSEC tools. I want to finish on one last point that Olaf brought up earlier, which was about innovation and about language and messaging, and about how we need to speak about DNSSEC and Dane. Russ and I even had a little discussion on these slides and some stuff on this. For so long, we're the DNS geeks, we're the folks who are the early adopters, we're the folks who are using this. We speak in the language of this. But as an example, you know, if we go out here and talk about zones, all right, to the rest of the people in this in ICANN, how many people here out there will talk about zones? Right? Out of the 2,600 participants who are here, there's probably 2,500 who don't think of zones. They think of domains. And so I think I would put the message out to kind of what Olaf was talking about selling the innovative use of Dane, selling the business value of it and things. We also need to think about the language we're using when we talk about DNSSEC and talk about the tools that are here and how we make what we say more accessible to those other people who are out here who just think in more regular terms. And it's a challenge we all have, and we need to look at how we do that with DNSSEC. So with that, we'll encourage you to look at these things, and for any of you who can be part of this next time in Durban, I will also say we'll be putting out a call for papers and proposals. If you've got a good tool, service, idea, if you'd like to be part of one of the panels that are part of this, if you've got a lesson to Russ's last point that you'd like to share with people, please watch for that or even talk to us. Say, I've got an idea. I'd love to be part of this next time. Let us know. We're always looking for people. So thank you very much. Any last... Okay.